This is Marissa Nadler, and you're listening to WPRK in Winter Park, Florida.
Attention, Orlando.
Your DJ has spent hours setting up his lights. He spent ages performing sound checks. He's keeping reasonably sober. And is prepared to play just about anything you care to ask for.
It's raining men!
Get ready for a very special night and party celebration.
Ladies and gentlemen, the show is about to begin.
Turn your back on Mother Nature. Good morning, Winter Park. This is Punkonomics with your host, Dr. Benny Ballack. And today's guest is Corey Carroll. And my name is Jesse Velez. I'm co-hosting Punkonomics today. And let's say hello to Corey and, of course, our host, Dr. Ballack.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hey, guys.
Hey, guys. So what can I say? Long week. Very busy. A lot of comedians making fun of the president and the candidates. And today we're going to touch on some taboos. Which is the first one?
Yeah, so we have Corey back, you know, because we need, there's so many taboos. In fact, there's so many of them. So we're happy to have Corey back to keep plugging at it. We'll see. We'll, you know, keeping the conversation going. I think I have going with Chris to come next week, and then we'll see, maybe some surprises. I didn't watch the debate. It's just so boring.
You let us torture ourselves, huh?
Well, you had it on Punkonomics, on the Facebook page. There was a leaked memorandum of understanding, a memorandum of understanding between the two parties as to the ground rules, as to, you know, how the candidates have to conduct themselves, what the moderator's allowed to do, what the audience is allowed to do, what are the issues that...
No real questions.
That's right, you know. Right. And it's kind of like what I was saying last week, is that most presidential debates are... It's basically just a place for candidates to restate their platform and, you know...
Yeah, in a theatrical form, and again, it's scandalous, really, you know? I mean, I think I also posted, you know, and by the way, if I say, oh, I posted, and you go there and it's not there, you just ask for it on the group, on the page, the Punkonomic page, and we'll respond, but, yeah, we're being played again. I mean, you know what, now I'm 46, I used to be more naive, I never thought of myself as naive, I was usually the least naive guy in the room, but sometimes I wonder, I mean, just how bad it is. Nobody's even pretending anymore.
You know, I was watching it in the debate with my dad, and my dad still, you know, he's got a lot of faith in the political system. He's not a skeptic quite like I am. And even he said, he's like, you know, these don't seem like real questions that the audience is asking, because I think the very last question, right, and this is supposed to be a spontaneous thing, right, a town hall. Mm. The very last question was, you know, if you could just take a minute to tell the world, like, you know, how are you misunderstood as a person? How is that a real question? What audience actually ask that?
It's a beauty pageant, you know? It's like, it's toddlers and tiaras meets Godzilla, you know?
And also, it's horrible. The other thing is, everybody in the town hall, I never noticed this before, but they all had note cards at the question.
Like, yeah, it's all vetted.
If I went to a town hall and I had a question, I guarantee you I don't need a note card.
In fact, most town halls, it was, you know, it evolved. The man is making, you know, who took the joke, which is what's left of the democratic process, and really taking it to the extreme, is the famous, infamous Karl Rove. You know, you might know him from Family Guy as the evil emperor, otherwise as the main campaign genius for George W. Bush. So, you know, these town hall meetings, he's the trailblazer here. Everybody tries to copy him. The town meetings are completely fake. Just like all those authentic people we see, you know, remember Joe the plumber, remember the
right.
Welfare queens, even already from Reagan era, so that's pre-Rove, you know. They never existed. These people are working for parties. They're getting paid by the political parties. All these authentic people, you hear their real stories. The stories are lies. The people are actors. There's no exception. Everything's fake. You know?
Well, you know, last night I was watching Jon Stewart, and of course they had President Obama on. And first thing he does is he directs the attention to a group of women that they brought into the show. Mm. And of course, right away, he just kind of went like, well, you know, I didn't arrange that. It was somebody else. But it, just like when you see any other candidate, President Obama, whoever, when you look in the background, it's almost like they handpick each person that they have in the background.
They do.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
The thing is, they do.
Yeah.
They do. Without exception, everything. And it can be, you know, it can be innocuous, you know, where you choose the nice plethora of good-looking but not too good-looking people.
Make
as
sure
a good
you get
background.
A nice ethnic,
you know,
mix in,
oh,
there,
yes,
right? Age, you know, mix.
Yeah.
You got it. It's for the campaign.
But then it gets ugly, too. It gets literally that a lot of these campaigns, a lot of these stories that we hear, especially the scandalous ones, are completely fabricated. People are talking about taboos. You know, I try and be equal opportunity hater here as promised, but it has to be said that the Republicans are better at this. Yes, absolutely.
they're better at this. They're better actors or better liars.
So you know, how about sinking Herman Cain's campaign? I mean, you know, I really wonder. First of all, you know, was there really a scandal there? And did anybody really care? I didn't care. I still would have voted for the guy. I mean, I think Herman Cain probably sunk his chances as a political candidate when he came out and said that no bill would be longer than 5 pages or something like that. Instantly, the powers that be are like, well,
we can't hide all that pork in there.
We can't hide anything in 5 pages. No, I mean, 5 pages, we'd actually have to say what we want to do.
I wonder to what extent he was even a viable candidate or even also a semi-actor, you know, under some kind of shady deal behind about, okay, we need you to do this, to perform this role in this theater. Please do it and your bank account will feel better afterwards.
You know, you got to admit he was a great comedian, though. I mean, he was so natural.
He was kind of self-effacing. Right? I mean, you know, he didn't take it too seriously. I would have loved to have seen his hat in the ring. I mean, you know, 999 plan. Even if it's regressive and doesn't make sense, I mean, how great is that? We get to say we have a tax policy based on a pizza promotion.
Well, but you're right. It's better to have a pizza promotion than the outright fraud that we have from the big guys, right? We live in a strange times, no doubt. But again, I mean, these guys are made fools of, you know, made fun of, while the serious candidates are supposed to be experts. Talking about taboo, I'm eager. Got a senior doing a paper on the Romney Ryan 5-point plan.
Right.
It's a very, very challenging paper, right? Oh. So shout out.
I'm not sure if it was
so much BS, you know.
Somebody sent me a link on Facebook, and it said that. And I'm trying to be politically neutral here, but this is just great marketing. It said that, you know, get the details of the Romney tax plan, right? And it's just a simple webpage. It's romneytaxplan.org. I think it's a website. And there's a button right in the middle. And it says, click here for the details. And when you go to click it, the button moves. Yeah. You can chase this button all over your screen. But you can't click it. And, you know, it's Democratic Party put
it. Sure, clever commercial.
It's very clever. Funny, yeah, there are no details. Yeah. You can't get the details.
Yeah, and again, I mean, easy to be equal opportunity on this one because on the other side,
You know, I would love to actually see the details because, you know, you could write that tax plan out and you could say, okay, here's what we're going to do and here are our assumptions for how you're going to balance the budget. And the assumption to balance the budget under their so-called plan is that you're going to have massive economic growth, right? Mm-hmm. There's going to be some sort of a government multiplier to tax cuts. Oh, who is that? Art Laffer, I think. You know, Laffer curve, right? He had the notion, you know, tax avoidance and then the multiplier effect of tax cuts.
Yeah, and the Reagan, it's actually a great example. So let me go on a tiny tangent here. The Laffer curve is something when I was an undergrad in the late 80s, we were taught that by generally conservative, typical economists, of that it doesn't work. That here's an example of a policy gimmick that you know, that didn't really work. The idea being that if you cut taxes, especially to the wealthy, but overall, you actually get more money. Now, it sounds counterintuitive, a little bit. On paper, it's quite clever, you see? I mean, because if by cutting taxes, you get the economy stimulated, then people do more business, and therefore, even if you're taxing a smaller fraction, you're getting more government revenue. So this is kind of in a Reagan era, early Reagan era, that was kind of a theory that, until it was quickly discovered that it just doesn't work like that, that all the data was overwhelmingly showing that it doesn't work. And so I went to graduate school in the late 80s, right, and learned all that. You know, here's an example of how it doesn't work, right? And now I come back, and that zombie has arisen back from the dead, you know, trickle down. The tax cut to the wealthy, maybe we should spend a little bit of even semi-tech time, because it's very simple why it doesn't work. It hasn't worked. It works under extreme conditions when you have a booming economy, like in America in the Kennedy era, where Kennedy cut taxes to the wealthy. The economy was booming, was red hot. And the taxation was stifling of the upper classes who were at the time, unlike today, investing in technology, enhancing their businesses. Now it all goes out of the country in a second because the wealthy getting the tax cuts that are supposed to create jobs, they siphon it out because there's no good investments in America.
Well, you know, and as a qualifier here to our listeners, something like this, it is sort of technical because it's not a linear thing. I mean, your example of during the Kennedy era, I mean, what were top marginal tax rates then? I mean, I know they went as high as 95% after World War II. I don't know the exact timetable on that.
And that's not on all your income. That's on that tenth million dollar you make. But people forget that when we hear these big percentages, it's not on the entire income of the wealthy.
Just as a quick side thought, you know, when was the last time we changed the income brackets here in this country? When was the last time we actually said, okay, let's add a couple new brackets? Because, I mean, you know, in all seriousness, I mean, you know, you have people now that, not many of them, obviously, but you have people that make over $100 million a year on a somewhat routine basis. I mean, why isn't there a bracket for that? You know,
in fact, we don't even measure it. Again, it gets worse. It gets worse. It's like, is this the word of the decade? You know, you can immediately say that it gets worse. In fact, when you hear the horrendous numbers about income distribution, wealth distribution in America, numbers that resemble at best, third world dictatorships. Some of us are beginning to compare it to France right before the revolution in terms of, I mean, we're talking like pre-market system. Basically kind of new feudal distribution of income here, like in the late Middle Ages when things were going bad. Having said that, the top 1% are basically not even measured. Certainly the top 0.001% who literally own the world, if you will, a large chunk of it. Those people, like you say, making many millions a year in income and sitting on sometimes billions in assets. These few tens of thousands, I don't know, 100,000 people in the entire planet, we don't even count their income. It's not even entered into the averages. And maybe to cap all this, so we're not just doing what's the polite way? Starts with a B session. Whining session. Polite, right? I don't think
bourgeois?
I can. No, I didn't mean that. I meant something usually referred to the female of the dog.
Yeah. You know?
Oh, okay.
A dog-esque session. it's a big taboo, right? The fact that our tax system is fake progressive, you know, then you can get, Romney, and simply because he has to tell I don't care about his feelings, but that he feels obliged to talk to the very wealthy, powerful people in America, and what he has to tell them to make him happy is that half of Americans are parasites. Then I'm reminded of Marie Antoinette saying that, well, if the people don't have bread, let them have cake. And you know what happened to her, don't you?
Right, right. Well, you know, I've noticed that culturally, we're starting to accept three classes. The rich, the middle class, and the ones that don't have any.
The middle class, by and large, doesn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, growing up in the 70s that you were, you know, for whatever words you want to put it, labeled as upper middle class, lower middle class. It seems like now when people are talking about economics, you know, the wealth or whatever, you never hear those words anymore.
Mm. Oh, you hear. I mean, you know, in the campaign, they never talk about the poor, by the way. You know, you have one in five American children are malnourished from poverty. But nobody says the P word, right? Not even Obama, which is really something that he really ticks me off. You see, I'm adopting clean words, you know, into my vocabulary. practicing at night.
You know, we should do a safe harbor show at night, you know, after 10 o'clock and just really let it all hang out.
The uncensored version.
Uncensored version.
Really, I mean, anger is anger. And that's another thing, right? You're not supposed to be angry.
I love British politics, by the way. I love watching, like, the House of Lords. You know, you go on to... I think you can see it on C-SPAN occasionally. But, I mean, you know, they get out...
Questions.
They stand up, they yell at each other, you know, in their face. Yeah. Well, the, you know... I come up with some British term. I can't think of any non-profanity.
No, but they have this kind
of... Little wanker from Wilshire. Yeah. You know, please explain his position. Yeah. Why can't we do that?
Well, though, in some sense it's become... I mean, sure, it would be nice, but in some sense even that has become a bit of a theater now. I mean, the real deals are done behind. Why? The same reasons. You know, you don't have real representation. You don't have small businesses. You have a handful of giant multinational corporations who run the government. On their board sit the very same 100,000 people, whether you're looking at the New York Times or Lockheed Martin. I mean, these are the same people sitting on those boards. And then that's how the New York Times become the marketing department of the military-industrial complex. It's not because... But all of these things, then, we're not allowed to get angry about it. Look at the response to Occupy. Look at the response to the at least initial public anger expressed by the so-called Tea Party my problem with the Tea Party, that it got co-opted by the very same people who...
They're good. I mean,
they're very clever again, you know. Karl Rove and company and all of those very, very, very clever people. But the fundamental sentiment that you're getting... it starts with an, you know, that the government is not really working for you. I couldn't find a clean way to say what the government is doing to you, but they're doing it in the name of these very same economic elites. We're not allowed to get angry about it, right? Left or right, we're somehow
anti-American.
Right, basically. You can't. We're really. I mean, in some cases, of course, you have, and in academia we have it, and people, you should know that. What made the academic freedoms that made the American education system what it is, it's still top in the world despite all the attempts to dumb it down, certainly at the university level, the war's out there, you know, to shut this up, you know, so that we don't talk about it. So that, and allow me to quote, co-founder of The Economist, man had better be uneducated than educated by his masters. Wow. That's like 1870s. It's not a new problem.
There was something that happened, I think it was last week, and it seems like it got shoved underneath the rug. Citibank, CEO, all of a sudden dropped off the face of the earth. You guys want to comment on that?
That's an internal power struggle. Vikram Pandit, When he became CEO of Citibank, he basically said, "Don't pay me, just, you know, pay me in stock." And that was seen as kind of unpopular. Yeah, maybe actually that's true. Pay for performance. Don't try and compare yourself to Steve Jobs. But I don't really think it's anything significant. I don't think there's any scandal there. It's just an internal power struggle.
Yeah, I'll admit I'm not familiar specifically on that.
I mean, usually when somebody drops off like that, there's something in the background. There's some kind of a power move.
That's what, you know, Citibank, this. They just finally reported their first really good quarter since the financial crisis. And I get the feeling that, you know, the board of directors, they didn't want Pandit to take credit for it. They didn't want him to actually gain too much power in the company. So it's, you know, force him out. And I highly doubt Pandit's too upset. You know, I mean, it's not like he's in the poorhouse by any means. He's probably sipping a Mai Tai somewhere and, you know, Pandit will be just fine.
Now, there was something really curious in the debate, it was Romney kind of pressing Obama's buttons, and it had to do with the pension. And Romney kept saying, have you checked your pension?
Clearly, Romney's campaign has checked his Obama's pension, because he wouldn't be saying it otherwise.
Right. Is he just referring to Obama's 401k?
It's very difficult to have any investment now. If you're going to be in the public markets, it's very difficult to have any investment where one of the companies where you own stock in doesn't have some sort of an operation in China. It's a global market. So, I mean, I guess what, you know, Romney's saying is, you know, you too have a financial stake in outsourcing jobs to China and, you know, profiting from it. You know, that's what he's saying.
It was pretty deceiving, though. I mean, the way it came across is kind of like something very cynical, like Obama had a couple companies that were also outsourced, but that's not the case. I checked. I didn't see him. You can't avoid
these sort of things eventually. And again, this actually ties back a little bit to the economics we were discussing before, the fact that we do not have a recovery in America through financial means. You know, again, why aren't the wealthy investing in America? The so-called job creators. They all know. You're hearing me? You know you didn't create any jobs in the past 5 years, don't you? I mean, how much denial do you have?
You know, this goes...
You're counting the money, all the money, all the tax breaks you've received, the millions that could be used for food stamps, you know, but no, we're cutting that. Instead, you know what you did with it? You transferred it out of state, didn't you? Out of the country, didn't you? You invested where investment is good, in the Gulf, you know, in China. So who's the patriot here? You know, it's the whatever's left of the middle class slowly becoming poor, and the poor who are investing in America, the only people who are. If you want the wealthy to invest in America, or anybody to invest in America, it has to be a positive investment reality. And of course, that nobody's talking about. What do we need? Our infrastructure is rotten. Our skill base is falling apart. The environment is no longer conducive to innovation and small businesses. They keep saying small business, small business, small business, while at the same time both of them destroying them completely, destroying it completely. So again, you know, the double talk is tremendously destructive. They talk about issues that are close to our heart and do the opposite, not even behind our back anymore.
On the jobs front, though, I mean, you know what. And this goes to one of the taboos we were talking about last week, you know, technology basically destroying labor. The investment that you have seen in the U.S., right, the reinvestment that you have seen, it's largely gone into automation technologies or you know, on the enterprise level, it's a lot of investment has gone into software, which, again, is a form of process automation. So, yeah, I mean, there has been some investment, but no, it hasn't created any jobs. I mean, there haven't been any jobs created.
There was an aberrant, actually, statistics a few months back. God, I'm getting old, you know, senior moment. I don't know if it was 3 months or 5 months, but actually manufacturing rose a little bit in America.
Yeah. Oh, no, manufacturing output is a larger percentage of GDP.
No, employment. Manufacturing employment rose. How weird is that? Well, apparently we're getting to the point where some heavy industry in Canada are threatening their workers, often more unionized than in America, that if they don't take lower pay, they will move to America.
Another.
So we're beginning to look like a third world country attracting the slave labor, and that's not good for the future. Temporarily, it might provide some jobs. Great, that's nothing wrong with that, especially in this environment. But again, in the future, we need to be the robot programmers of this world.
A major driving force actually right now for the U.S. that's driving manufacturing back here. I mean, this is one of the, I guess if we can have a positive segment in this show, it'll be the next like 60 seconds. Energy costs here in the U.S. are actually very low compared to what they are worldwide. I mean, our energy costs, even though we've got great environmental quality here, right, which everybody will tell you, it's like, oh, gosh, you know, the EPA is just killing the electricity companies. That's why electricity is so expensive. Electricity in the U.S. is very cheap.
Sure.
Compared, I mean, we have some of the least expensive electricity in the world. We have cheaper electricity compared to China. And that's why a lot of manufacturing is actually relocating to the U.S. Like, you know, you see a lot of automotive manufacturing is being relocated to the southeastern United States. Again, no unions there, right? So labor might not...
Especially now that the police in South Carolina is harassing, like, German engineers for being, you know, you know, with all those racist laws now where, you know, somebody looks foreign, you're supposed to harass them. They didn't mean it against them, did they? You know, but that's...
Well, I mean, you know, BMW, Toyota, Hyundai, I mean, you know, a lot of these foreign car manufacturers, they're putting manufacturing facilities back in the U.S. because we have inexpensive electricity. And it's something that it's kind of an accident, right, that we have cheap energy right now. Electricity prices, I literally just got back from speaking about this up in Virginia. I was at an energy conference Wednesday. But electricity prices are usually set, the marginal price of electricity is set by natural gas. Natural gas right now is very cheap as a result of the shale boom. I'm calling it an economic accident. But it's something that if we really get ahead of it, it's an advantage we can keep here in the U.S. If the public is just educated. One thing I would tell our listeners is don't be afraid of nuclear energy. It's not such a
big
bad
advocate.
Thing. Yeah.
Again, it could be, right? I mean, we know that we have the technology. The problem is, again, to bring it to the big questions, what kind of regulation, supervision, quality standards can we expect? I'm a little concerned that as our bridge crumble, I mean, are the same useless bureaucrats and corrupt businessmen going to run those nuclear power plants?
As a quick technical interjection, you know, on this note, I would Google LFTR, right, and that'll tell you everything you kind of need to know about the nuclear debate. If you just Google LFTR, you'll see there are a ton of links on Google about, you know, how basically government sort of suppressed a technology that was significantly safer than what we're using.
Oh, right, you told me about that one.
Yeah.
Are they public?
No. It's not a stock symbol. It stands for liquid fluoride thorium reactor. It's an alternative
technology
to the light water reactors that we use now. And basically, a short version of the story is, we had back in the 50s and 60s, we had a choice between two different reactor technologies. One was an extremely safe, basically can't screw it up version of civilian nuclear power. It's very, very cheap electricity, cheaper than what we have now, you can't have an accident with it, the technology. It's just, it's not within the laws of physics. And then you have the light water reactor where you can have an accident, right? And that's what we have. And that's, you know, that was Fukushima Daiichi was a light water reactor. And the reason we went with light water reactors is that it was basically, they doubled as bomb factories for us. You know, one of the outputs from a light water reactor is, you know, this horribly contaminated fuel, but some of that horribly contaminated fuel is plutonium that you need to use to make a nuclear weapon. So.
Well, we're going to go into a little music break, and we'll definitely touch some more taboos. And there is a elephant in the room, and that stems from the last debate. Let's see if some of our audience can guess and call us here at WPRK. Next song is going to be from The Clash, The Guns of Brixton. Welcome back to WPRK, the best in basement radio, the voice of Rollins College. And you are listening to Punkonomics. And we had a caller while the music was going on, Rachel Thorne, a good shout out for you. She's out in Boston at Northeastern University. And she picked up right away on it. You know, some of us Neanderthals here didn't have a clue what was going on, you know, of course, but no. And this is, of course, a source of humor, but at the same time, it's serious. And it's the binders full of women. Now, while we were on break, we were discussing about the economic impact that women do have in the economy and how they're sort of being ignored. And I want to get our guests' opinions on that, as well as Dr. Balak's opinion on this. Guys?
Shall I start? Well, I'm a card-carrying feminist.
I'm a card-carrying feminist, so, you know, seriously. But the thing is, again, it's a lot about fakeness, isn't it? I don't know. Like I said, I didn't watch the thing, you know? So, yeah, I saw all the... I'll file the folder thing under, you know, in another folder with Big Bird or what have you, you know what I mean? Really, right? However, yeah, feminism is somewhat failed economically in recent times. Women are working... part of the gutting of the middle class is that everybody has to work. All members of the family have to work. So, you know, what do you do about the kids? That's highly expensive. Healthcare costs for women much higher than men, simply by, if you'll excuse me, ladies, you know, the nature of the plumbing. You know, we are low maintenance, simple machines, and you are complex. But remember back, you know, my students are going to be bored with it because we've heard it already 100 times. But, you know, I mean, this is kind of dawn of time thing. It's the miracle of creation. You know, women's bodies, if you look at the first religion on the planet, were these very fat, you know, very, very suggestive, big breasts, big tummy goddess, because the miracle of life was the source, was the godly thing, right? But pretty quickly, as we got to these initial empires in Mesopotamia, the Indus River, you know, and Yellow River in China, the king and his warriors decided that, wait a minute, there's this really, really valuable piece of capital here installed in half my population, and it's called the uterus. And it's remarkably efficient. It is what makes little babies and little workers, and I want to own it. And it's all been downhill since then, hasn't it? But today, it matters. So when we have a third world healthcare system that costs 5 times as more as other rich, industrial, sophisticated countries, because it's a racket for profit. That's why we have such a terrible healthcare system. I'm sorry, you know. We could fix it, but we don't. And Obamacare is barely a tweak. Women pay the bill. Right, because it costs them much more in terms of childcare, in terms of their medical upkeep. But the fight then degenerates into emotional issues where that are important, by the way. Reproductive rights actually is one of the places I think maybe the two parties do differ more than in most others. But then, you know, in most cases they're so similar. So in reproductive rights, which is another, a matter of control for women so that she owns her body. So it's unequal fundamentally, and if we don't deal with the underlying economic issues of the costs and benefits facing women, the fact that women have to pay up for the childcare to give us these young, you know, the future generation, but society benefits from that future generation, like survival, right, of the race, the fact that we continue to live, yet we don't pick up the tab, right? We have what we call in economics, right? I mean, you know, it's all about...
Market failure.
It's a market failure, right? This is a hidden benefit from children, you know, from being mothers, that we do not compensate that benefit. We do not pay for it, or at least allow women to exercise this without having costs that they have to incur that the rest of society doesn't want. So when women barely get 70 cents to the dollar still today, if you calculate it right, the excuse, if you will, coming from some kind of economic theory that you can guess I don't subscribe to, is that, well, they're going to have babies, you know? Maybe in the middle of the meeting, their kid will fall and hurt themselves, and then they will be called out of the important meeting to take care of the kid. And of course, here you have a bias that many people out there know, certainly the ladies, right? I mean, you know, if something happens to our kid, my wife will call me to go get him, because if she leaves the job, it'll be considered to be unprofessional, and then she won't be, you know, generic case here. A lot of women know about that. Well, she will not be promoted because she doesn't seem to be sufficiently loyal to the firm. When a guy does it, everybody goes, oh... You know, so there's a lot of these situations that go on, and they translate into many of billions of dollars that are essentially, worked for by women but not paid to women. And, I could connect that even to gasoline. You said energy is cheap. Well, we subsidize it. Now, maybe it's a smart thing to do, that we subsidize it to get it cheaper, but the reason why it's so cheap, if you add all the real costs into that, I'd say a few major wars... trillions will accumulate quickly.
Yeah, there's,
right?
there's a book.
How much are we really paying,
in
other words?
On that, like, miles per casualty or something like that.
Miles per casualty.
And basically, what they were talking about is, you know, the true cost of our oil, the true cost of our, mm-hmm. of our gas. You know, when you measure it in terms of soldiers that have died, you know, I mean, the human cost of it.
Right. treasure, you know, people, everything. Treasure being an archaic word for, you know, budgets, right? So we're talking about, but yet again, what are the two parties arguing about? Just how much to skin the poor and the disappearing middle class to pay the bills for, you know, ridiculous adventures that, by the way, easily predicted what they will do. You know, anybody who knew what the hell they were talking about could have told you how bad things will go.
We could get on
and it goes on.
We could get into a huge segue on this. I mean, you know, one thing on one end, you could just say the U.S.'s energy policy is very misguided. On another, you could say that this is part of a global chess game, and what we're doing is actually brilliant. We're sucking the Middle East dry of the one resource that they have. I mean, you know, 20 years from now, it's just going to be an uninhabitable sand pit, and they have no economic. Mm. Resources, you know, whatsoever.
You know, that's actually something that the old timers, at least when my folks sit around and coffee table and they talk about past times, you know, Eisenhower's, all those guys. That's one thing they do say is that it seems like it's a hidden or brilliant plan that we are actually sucking the gas out of the Middle East.
It's a great plan.
And it makes total sense.
I mean,
it really does.
I'm a bit of an armchair engineer. I know about these sorts of things, right? We can move away from oil. It's technologically viable, right? But it's going to be a pain. I mean, there's really no true substitute for oil. It's an amazing resource. It really is. And if you take that away from the Middle East, you suck that dry. They don't have anything. They have no productive agricultural lands to speak of, and that's certainly not relative to their population. I mean, you look at Egypt, right? You know, the quality of life in Egypt's terrible. And yes, they've had political problems. Yes, they've been repressed. But fundamentally, even if they had the most open and progressive democratic, you know, society, they would still be in a world of trouble because they have too many people, too little in terms of natural resources. I mean, they have 10 times the population from what the land can naturally sustain.
Though natural resources are a curse.
Dutch disease,
you from Dutch developing. Disease. So you have one of the reasons why you find naturally rich countries, you typically find the dictatorships. Usually the global powers that want that resource are the ones maintaining those dictatorships, in the case of the Middle East, universally.
Historically speaking, though, the U.S. would be the counterexample to that, because we were very endowed.
As a colony, or the history of the United States in the past? Absolutely.
We're the counterexample to Dutch disease. But yes, I mean, generally speaking, natural resources, they stifle economic development.
Yeah, there were a lot of, and it's just the size of it. I mean, the United States is somewhat of a peculiarity in this case. Also, won its independence successfully early on, and and the rest of the world didn't gang up, thanks to the French, you know. So did the Haitians, you know. But what happened to them is the rest of the world ganged up on them and have been, you know, savagely raping them consistently for a while, centuries, literally. Right. So America was spared that strong enough. So they're very different, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that, you know, at least, the population, there are issues, but going back to self-sufficient farming would be potentially, for a large majority of the population in some of these countries, perhaps a better situation than being the brunt of this wasteland, World War III.
Sure. The thing is, though, is that they don't have enough land to support that.
It happened before, you know, it happened to the, you know, in Rome, in the Italian peninsula, depopulated by, 80% once the ships from Egypt were carrying grain didn't show up anymore. And I think in some sense we might be experiencing something not necessarily
That depopulation, though, it goes two ways. I mean, one way to do it is people leave. The other way is people die.
You know, on that topic, I had somebody ask me the other day, you guys talking economics and all that, but where do you think is the new economic utopia? I mean, where's it going? I mean, we're definitely going downhill. Where's the new economy? What country?
Like where would, like, so yeah. If you had to move out of the United States, where would you move?
Well, I mean, which would be the next emerging economy?
I don't think there is one.
Exactly. No, that's quite true. I mean, yeah, again, just to raise the taboo, I keep, you know, it's my professor instinct, because I'm Mr. Tangent. My students know it. But by being Mr. Tangent, you have to also always kind of be ready to reel it back in. So talk about taboo. Yeah, the whole China thing, right? China taking over the world. No, it's not. In fact, I think if I had money to bet, I'd bet that they will go into civil war before they emerge as a global power as we stand. China is teetering for the same reason that everybody is. income distribution.
Right.
And yeah, there's a few people making a killing, but not only are there, used to be, what, 3 years ago, I would say, it's only the 200 million people living on the coast that are benefiting, even if as wage slaves working, making iPhones, they've still got a job out of this Chinese miracle. But what about the 800 million who are seeing their lives get worse and worse every year for the past at least 10 years, a little bit longer? 90s were good for everybody in China, but that's long gone, that game. But now we have literally the erosion of the new middle class. They just became first generation middle class in Shanghai and Beijing, and they can't afford housing in Shanghai and Beijing anymore. Because again, the luxury, the wealth moving fast upward. The same, you know, they also have their own banksters, the Chinese.
That's a bit of a failure of financial markets and also kind of their central planning. Because I've had a lot of friends go over to China in the last couple of years. And what they tell me is that, you know, you can go into some of these huge cities where it seems like there would be a shortage of housing, or it seems like, you know, the population density is just absurd. It's beyond like Manhattan.
But, you know, it's the complete opposite.
But yeah, I mean, there are empty buildings over there. There are, I mean, literally empty skyscrapers. We're talking about 50, 60-story buildings, brand new construction, really nice, and they're completely empty. And this could be in a city of 15 million people.
Shanghai is a good example
so,
of that.
So, I mean, you know, that's Shanghai. I mean, you there are probably cities that we've never heard of before. You have tons of examples like that.
Right.
I mean, that's what's amazing about China is how many cities the size of Manhattan they have.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, that's a failure of financial markets. That's a failure of the market in general, is when, you know, you don't have resources matched with, you know, consumers.
Yeah, and they've known it for years. They've been talking about it. They're failing, and politically, again, they're failing to deal with their issue that they cannot depend on the American consumer, especially since the American consumer is not consuming anymore so much. Certainly the Chinese goods, the very wealthy, the only people who are doing well prefer Italian goods, you know?
This goes back to last week's taboo. I mean, okay, so why are they building these buildings in the first place? They're building these buildings because it's an artificial form of short-term employment, and to some people in the right position, it's extremely profitable. Okay, so now nobody inhabits these buildings. So, you know, why is it? I mean, this is an aggregate demand problem, right? The worker can't
from last week,
the worker can't afford his own product. Now, when you get that, you get situations like China where the markets don't clear, where you have these unused, unpurchased, and uninhabited residences. I mean, you could go through not just the Chinese economy, but our economy, and you can find millions, if not billions, of examples where, you know, markets don't clear because it's an aggregate demand problem. I don't want to get too technical.
I mean, the fact that as people are not paid anymore, our wealth that was tied up for the vast majority of people in America and in their houses has deteriorated dramatically over the few years. We are rationally not shopping anything like we did a few years ago in all classes of society. And that's what Corey means when he talks about aggregate demand, the demand in the markets of all people together as we paid less and less. You know, back in the day where capitalism was being built in America, people like the famous Nazi sympathizer, it's no bleeding heart liberal, you know, Ford, right? Henry Ford, he paid his...
You know, that's right.
Yeah, he was funding the Nazi. I mean, he wasn't alone, by the way, but that's maybe another taboo. You know, who exactly the upper classes around the world in America supported in the 30s.
He wanted his workers to be able to afford to buy one of the cars.
Exactly.
You know, the example I gave last week, Lee Iacocca, right? The first time he saw a robot, he said, okay, well, how's the robot going to buy the car? I mean, and this is a problem. I mean, it's too technical for this show. You know, some people might believe that it's just a political problem, or, you know, or a fiscal problem. I actually believe it's a failure of a monetary system. But again, that's too technical for this show.
Sure, in that sense. But perhaps still, I mean, on the skirting around this, manufacturers, certainly traditional like car industry, were concerned with these issues. But part of the shift in the production in the rich world, and especially in America, going away from manufacturing into service sectors and such,
that mechanism is gone. It was like a Band-Aid short term. Because when you go to a service economy, it makes the aggregate demand problem a little less worse,
For a while, potentially.
A while.
Because you can't say, you know, I can't be sold a burger from China,
right?
Essentially, right? Yeah. But we find that a lot of the operation, other than the low wage poverty, you have to have three jobs, another taboo, right? You know, the typical poor American poor person works harder than anybody. Mm-hmm. Not leisurely or anything, you know. No moocher. But those jobs remain here, but all the specific, the mark, a tremendous amount of the operation can indeed be moved through technology, as I know you're correctly obsessed with, but also through political decisions, because we can make different choices. And this aggregate demand problem is everywhere. And China wants to do it. Here it seems like we don't even want to do it. In fact, both parties, and I want to bring it in there, talk about austerity. Now, it's not a bit, in Europe, everybody knows what austerity means, because that's what it's called in the media, and that's what is shoved down their throats in Europe now, too. We don't even question anymore that, you know, because both our parties promised that. We cut the welfare, you know, and welfare in economics is just how well you fare. The English word, it doesn't mean that you're getting welfare payments. That's a specific thing. Just your general economic well-being. We hit the middle class, whatever's left of the poor, you know, not much picking there anymore. But the middle class is rife to be violated here, and we're fighting over meager resources like warlords. You know, we're dismantling the market system that was based from its beginning on a balance, on a thriving middle class, on reinvestment, on planning for the future. And now we look more like the hills of, I mean, well, in much better conditions, but the hills of Afghanistan with powerful warlords running around from village to village taking what they can.
You know, I think part of the problem here, a bunch of economists, Daniel Kahneman being one of them, have studied this recently, is that it's basically like the economics of communicating information. Right, the austerity argument is extremely easy to communicate because of, you know, they liken the national budget to the personal household.
God, yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Right? Which, you know, I mean, it kills someone like Ben, kills someone like me, you know, somebody who's actually gone through introductory economics classes.
Complete fraud.
But to the person who hasn't taken economics class, to the layman, it's an easy story to sell. Mm-hmm. It's an extremely easy story to sell. So, I mean, rather than sit here and try to explain it to you, I'm going to just say, trust us. Okay, trust us.
No,
I mean,
even,
you know, this is an extremely boring subject matter. We've
famous last words, trust us.
Yeah, it's not even so complicated in all honesty.
You can fix debt with more debt, right? We've been doing it for a long time. I mean, you know, look, listen to Krugman.
Hell, listen to Reagan.
Right.
You know, we live in a world in which, you know, we talk about the last liberal president in America from economic point of view was Richard Nixon.
Exactly.
You know, and that's a fact. You know, and if Reagan came up from the grave today, and you know, and I know a lot of conservatives really love him, and my God, you'd call him a socialist today, because he was in policy, Ronald Reagan, in every way, even in talking about evil empires and such, you know, to the left of Barack Obama.
Right.
In every single aspect of his policies. So this is to, at the very least, we need to kind of remind ourselves that something's really funny about this picture. And realize that it's a fraudulent
picture. Here's where the fraud kind of becomes apparent, because, okay, we've got the impending fiscal cliff, right? Everybody's, you know, everybody hears about the fiscal cliff. So, on the right, they, you know, even they don't want the fiscal cliff to happen. This is the party that's pushing, you know, the need for a balanced budget,
yeah, well,
right? But, okay, if this is such a great thing that's just going to, you know, stimulate private investment, right? Why is it that you're afraid of the fiscal cliff again? You know, why is it you're afraid of, you know, this huge tax increase coupled with a reduction in government spending, which, yeah, it's, you know, bragging.
You know, Bernanke, I think, is a funny character to bring up here, because, you know, George W. Bush chose Bernanke, basically the most conservative, hard right core working, you know, top economist in the world, you know, so in some sense, give him the credit, you know.
Monetary dove.
All liberals were like,
monetary dove. It's not Faulkner now. We don't have Faulkner in office. He is a dove.
Well, you have to. I mean, what he's doing is just the basic within the system, and we can talk maybe another time about fiat money and gold standard and the
that's a show I would love to come back to.
You know, we can
I'll prepare that to the nuts, because
there's a lot of interesting, and in fact, you know, it's a lot of the conspiracy theories are right. You know, the question is, what do you do about it? What exactly does it mean?
Yeah, you don't have a lot of choices.
But exactly. But still, Bernanke now is pulling the hairs out of his beard, because this is a man who made his career, you know, studying the Great Depression.
Right.
And conservative as he is, he's not an idiot, by far, you know. He knows exactly, again, and they're making him do it again. The man wrote the book, if you will, about how we had a crash in 29. There was an end of a long series of crashes due to misguided policy, which was very, you know, conservative in a bad way before it. And then the politicians played the very same game in the early 30s and brought the world down in the Great Depression in 32 by doing exactly what he is being told to do now. So imagine his position. You know, I wouldn't believe, you know, a few years back, ask me, would I be sympathetic of Ben Bernanke? Well, I wouldn't believe it, but here I am, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Bernanke's job...
He has to sink the American economy.
In terms of, like, his proper job title, okay, you know, you have to manage... Or he's the head of the Federal Open Market Committee, right? Head of the Federal Reserve. They're in charge of setting monetary policy. It's an incredibly simple job, right? He has spent a total of 10 seconds thinking about, you know, what the Fed should do.
He's not given much chances. I mean, if they're going to do austerity in all every way and mess up with the budgets and make cuts where people would actually spend, all he can do is promise to support. What he's doing, I mean, all his quantitative easing, is not some kind of Illuminati cabal of the international New World Order. He's just, you know, you're going to sink. I'm going to try and throw out, like, life vest at you. You're all going to die anyway. But at least, you know, I'm the life vest guy. So I'll just inflate. I promise to inflate as much as I can to support the dollar.
Which, by the way,
what can he do?
Now he's kind of having, you know, now people at the Fed are kind of saying, hey, guys, we might not be able to create inflation. We might actually have to do the helicopter thing because of, you know, this mechanism might be broken. I mean, it's true. The people at the Fed, they know what they're doing. The Congress is screwing them over, right? QE would work if you had the fiscal measures in place to facilitate it. But, I mean, right now, you know, Bernanke spends all of his time...
Dysfunctional.
He spends all of his time trying to say, it's like, okay, well, how am I going to explain this to the American people? And how am I going to explain this to our politicians? That's what he spends all his time doing.
Yeah.
We're
running out of time, right?
Yeah, running out of time. So I guess in conclusion, even though Bernanke might be a genius, he's a tool.
Well, he's not. I wouldn't discount him as a tool, but you know he doesn't have a lot of options where he's at.
I'm just poking fun at him. Maybe he'll get proactive and do something for us.
Yeah.
But anyway, folks, we would like to thank you for listening to our program, Punkonomics, and I'd like to thank our guest, Corey Caro, and of course our host, Dr. Benny Balick. And in the spirit of punk, I'd like to bring to you the king of punk, or the granddaddy of punk.
That's a serious claim right there.
Iggy Pop.
Iggy's all right. I can go with that.
We have an old classic that most people can't even understand the lyrics, but for some reason, Iggy didn't do his drugs that day, and you can understand him. Here it goes.
Uh-oh. Just wanna sing Louie.